Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives and those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to begin by reminding you that a real friend of this program, Charlie Fabian, is continuing to volunteer to handle any suggestions, comments, bits of information you think might help us prepare these programs. Please send any and all of that to charlie.info438@gmail.com. Once again, charlie.info438@gmail.com. Today's program, we'll be talking about the union efforts at Starbucks, a remarkable admission of the failed British university system on economic grounds. And then finally, a discussion in the first half of the United Auto Workers and the big negotiation going on there. In the second half of the show, we will have Eleanor Goldfield, who's just completed a film on the Redwood Forest and the struggle to save and protect that forest from the entities for whom profit is the number one thing in the world and who are cutting down those trees. So let's jump right in. September of every year is when we celebrate Labor Day. We have it at the first Monday, but it's really the whole month that we should be thinking about labor, its history, the struggles of working people to get a fair shake in a society that makes that difficult for most people. And I want to talk today about a success story of the labor movement here in the United States. And it's a struggle about which little is known, because for every time that a journalist tries to tell part of that story, particularly a part showing the success workers have had, there's a barrage of strangely quickly appearing noise in the world of media that fudges what is one, what isn't one, what is happening and what isn't. So I want to set the record straight and talk about the effort of people working at Starbucks, the coffee shop company that everyone watching and listening knows real well. Here we go. The first successful effort to form a union of the people working at Starbucks took place in Victoria, British Columbia, back in August of 2020. The first successful effort in the United States waited another year plus beyond that, December of 2021 in Buffalo, New York. Since that time, and mark these numbers because this is what success looks like. Since those early beginnings, and to this point, 448 stores in 46 states out of 50 here in the United States have filed to unionize. Many elections are underway and coming up. 322 stores, Starbucks stores, in 42 states have won their elections. The unions are thereby legally established. That is an amazing record. In a few years' time, thousands of Starbucks workers who had no union, who had no job protection, who got underpaid, reacted, took the time, the trouble, and had the courage to fight a bitter fight with a nasty employer trying to stop them at every turn. I'll get to that nastiness in a minute. But you know, even if you win an election and you are now the legally established union, winning an election means a majority of the workers in that workplace voted for a union, a democratic decision. One of the few places where democratic decisions happen in the world of business. Okay, once that happens, the company can choose not to bargain with you, can pretend to bargain, stall it all out, because if there's no union you're meeting with, if there's no contract you have signed, the workers don't have that much more protection than they had before. They're not protected by a legally binding contract. So what Starbucks did, and it's hardly alone, is tried every strategy in the book to prevent, to stall, to postpone any serious bargaining to reach a legally binding contract. So bad was it, and I want to get my numbers straight here, that the National Labor Relations Board had filed 93 complaints for inappropriate, illegal behavior against the Starbucks Corporation for illegally stalling in post-election negotiations. The New York Times referred to Starbucks' behavior as, quote, time-buying, morale-eroding, innocent-seeming, doing nothing. So the union reacted and set up one-day strikes around the country, one-day actions, and appealing to others in the community to understand the bitter nastiness of Starbucks. And I want to call out one group who found a way to do it, the students at Cornell University. They have a student assembly there, and the student assembly voted to cancel the contract between Cornell Student Union, the Cornell University institution, and Starbucks. And I want to read you the statement made by Student Assembly President Patrick Kuhl. Here we go. Everyone was on board, he's talking about the students, with the fact that Starbucks broke the law and Cornell doesn't support labor violations. Not only did they get the contract with Starbucks ended, they've also petitioned the United Nations International Labor Office to investigate the anti-worker activities of Starbucks. If you want to support this successful strike and unionization wave at Starbucks, go to their website. They are running a campaign with the slogan, No Contract, No Coffee. And I am proud to be able to bring such a success story of workers mobilizing, finding allies, in this case, students, to work with them. It is a sign of hope and change in the United States. Not the words, the actions. My next update has to do with a decision made in Great Britain. Universities in England are doing something which may give ideas here into the United States, and I want to expose it before it gets here. Universities in England are offering a three-day week to students. Why? Cramming all the classes into 3 days, cramming all the other activities at the university into 3 days. The answer, I quote, I am not making this up, is to give students the chance to hold jobs because they can't pay for the British universities, because their parents can't pay, and they don't want to come out overloaded with debt, you know, the way we do here in the United States. In 2021, 34%, a third of students, had jobs. By now, it's 50%. Of the freshmen entering this semester, two-thirds, or 67%, expect to need jobs. And the university is cooperating. And this has two consequences I want you to think about. If you're working 3 to 4 days out of the week, and the other three you're going to school, your schoolwork is going to suffer because of the time you spend working, the energy you spend. This is an awful way to diminish the quality of your education. And here's the second economic aspect of all of this. You're worsening wages in the country because you're sending millions of students into the labor force. If they have to work, they're going to be competing for jobs with people who are finished with school, adults, the rest of the working class. And you're therefore weakening the ability of workers to get paid well. This is an awful solution. Only the mentality of a conservative government interested in profiteering and supporting business and cutting wages and making students work 3 to 4 days out of the week. What a failure of a university system. What a failure of a capitalism that behaves and moves in such ways. The third economic update we'll have time for today concerns a union, the United Auto Workers, a legendary player in the labor movement of the United States for many, many decades. It has been preparing to deal with its problems as a 150,000 member union, crucial to the American economy, the producers of the automobiles and trucks we drive, and so on. I want to talk about what it means to get ready. Their contract with Ford, GM, and Stellantis, the successor of Dodge and Chrysler and so on, their contract ended September 14th, and they've been preparing to deal with the abusive treatment they've gotten from their employer, from the lack of wages keeping up with inflation, from all the problems besetting the American labor movement. And so they elected new leaders, much more militant and determined than before. Let me read to you a recent statement by the new UAW leader, Sean Fain. Quote, "Our employers only value one thing, profit. They do not value us. And the only way the working class advances is if we stand together." So they practice picketing. They practice striking. They practice sharpening and improving all the communications that make them a solid union. They developed their strategy. And one of them, one strategy, was to reach out to the larger community, particularly in Detroit, the base of our auto industry. And I want to read to you the statement made by Brandon Snyder, executive director of Detroit Action, which is a union of black and brown, low and no income people, homeless and housing secure. Detroit's fighting for housing and economic justice. Here's what he said about the readiness of the union. "It's a really important time to be able to close the gap that black workers and workers overall are feeling and experiencing when it comes to jobs, when it comes to economic justice. And it's a really important time to be able to stand up for workers and for demanding, you know, fair treatment and fair wages. This solidarity is that union's profound commitment, as it is the community's commitment, to begin to change an economy far too far under the control of corporations and far too little in the hands of the people who ought to be the focus of any decent economy." Stay with us. We'll be right back with a remarkable interview with Eleanor Goldfield about saving the redwood forests. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's economic update. I am very happy to bring back to our cameras and our microphones Eleanor Goldfield. She's been on our program before, and it is a good thing for us that she's available once again. So before I introduce her, let me thank her publicly for giving us her time and her work. So thank you, Eleanor.
Thank you, Rick. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you. Okay, here we go. Eleanor Goldfield is a creative, radical journalist and award-winning filmmaker. Her work focuses on radical and censored issues via photo, video, and written journalism, as well as artistic mediums, including music, poetry, and visual art. She is a board member of the Media Freedom Foundation, a co-host of the podcast Project Censored, along with Mickey Huff, and also co-host of Common Censored, along with Lee Camp, who I might mention has also been on this program. She also assists in frontline action, organizing, and trainings. Her new film, To the Trees, can be previewed at tothetreesfilm.com. All right, let me jump right in with a little personal note. Many years ago, on a trip for other purposes to San Francisco, a friend of mine insisted that he take me to Muir Woods, a remarkable place just north in Marin County across the Golden Gate Bridge. I had never been to such a forest in my life. To be honest, I couldn't have imagined. It was, for me, as close as I can get to a religious experience. Walking in the then less touristically developed Muir Woods than it is today. But it was amazing, and it demanded the kind of poetic response that you've been able to achieve in this film. So I wanted to ask, you know, it's like a poem, your film. It's a poem to something extraordinary in the human experience, these magnificent ancient trees, one next to the other, in this meandering, moist brook. It's extraordinary. But I wanted to ask, why did you do this? You know, how did you experience this to the point where you would make a film like this about it?
Well, Rick, thank you, first of all, for saying that, because if I could just encapsulate a little bit of what you felt in those woods, then that was my goal. Yeah, so I went out there because I had been in touch with forest defenders, and I wanted to travel out there to do some ground support anyway. That's what we call when we support the climbers up in the trees. And then I brought my camera, because that's what I do. And I started sitting down and talking with people. And next thing you know, I have a lot of footage. And just like I did with my first film, I thought, well, I could put all this footage together and make a piece out of it and take other folks behind the so-called beauty screens and behind the corporate censorship.
And so a film came out of that experience.
It did.
All right. I'm an economist, so I pay attention in a different way. And stimulated by those forests, I began asking questions. And one of the answers to the question I asked was, well, these are magnificent. Of course, they can't be cut down anymore, so we can preserve them. And the person I was with looked at me as if I were born yesterday and explained to me they are being cut down because people want panels in their den room, they want picnic tables, they want. So my question to you, are they still being cut down? And how is that possible?
Yes, it is a remarkable question, and answer. But as you know, the fact that something is beautiful or breathtaking or unique and cannot be replaced means nothing to the capitalist system. And the same goes for the Redwood Forest. There is nothing illegal, and one of the folks in the film says this, there is nothing illegal in cutting down a tree that is more than 2,000 years old. And people use it, hold on to your seats, folks, primarily for decking. That is what the market dictates is the biggest price point for redwood, one of the most carbon-rich forests in the world. As you pointed out, it's absolutely breathtaking. It's like walking through Narnia. And yet people will clear cut it and make it into decking. And I think it's important that we also highlight clear cutting, because this is not selection logging. Selection logging is the idea that you go into a forest that has protections and you are only allowed to log select trees, either because they have grown to past a certain point, or because that you have some understanding or agreement with the ecosystem and how it's structured. That's selection logging. But clear cutting is what happens pretty much in all industrial logging. And there are some private landowners that do more of the selection logging aspect. But by and large, for instance, Green Diamond, who owns 400,000 acres in the Pacific Northwest, they clear cut. That's what they do. And so the forests that you mentioned, those would just look like an absolute deadly nothingness, a void of what once was. And that is really what happens with these forests. They are not protected in any real way, not by the state, not by the federal government. And only 2% of those redwood forests still exist from before the Europeans first landing here. And that's only about 120, 150 years of industrial logging. 2% of the redwood forests. That's horrific and ongoing.
So it's not an exaggeration to say that the Europeans, when they came here, not only engaged in ethnic cleansing of the people, but have continued even after the people are largely gone or stuck in horrific reservations. They're now destroying the eco-environment that those people had enjoyed for millennia before. I want to push this a little further just to get your thoughts. We do have in the United States, thanks to people like you, we have laws that say you can't tear down these buildings over here because they are historic or unique or especially beautiful in the architecture or whatever. And so you can't just knock it down. And if you do, there's a prosecution and you will have to pay, etc. Why is it then, when you have these trees that are obviously unique, spectacular, unreplaceable for thousands of years, blah, blah, why does it not exist for them?
It's a brilliant question, and I wish I had the answer to it. But again, the capitalist system dictates that things that are finite, such as clean air or clean water or these remarkable forests, that capitalism treats those as infinite. Oh, we can just keep drilling. We can keep cutting down. We can keep destroying. And things that are infinite, like ones and zeros on a screen, treats it like those are finite. Like, oh, we have to protect the money when it's just, that's just a dream, a concept that we came up with. And so it is absolutely disgusting. And I look at other nations, particularly in South America, for instance, who have rewritten their constitutions to include human rights, basic human rights for ecosystems. Recognizing, of course, that humans are a part of these ecosystems, and if they die, we will die too. But of course, we've never rewritten our constitution because we're of the opinion that a bunch of dead old white dudes who owned other human beings are really the best that we can do in terms of a constitution. So there you are.
Okay. Again, putting on my economist hat for a moment. If I understand you correctly, then the following sentence is true, that the profit drive of timber companies is trumping, and I intend the implication of using the word, is trumping what overwhelming majority of Americans, I am sure, would prefer, to have those trees, to have that experience available to them, their children, and everybody else, rather than redwood decking. Actually make people use other materials, dozens of possibilities come to mind, to make the deck that you want. That this is not giving up something fundamental. It's giving up something marginal to hold on to something awesomely fundamental. I mean, it would be then, and maybe that's your point and the point of your film, this would then become an example of profit craziness on a scale that even people who like capitalism would have to admit is nothing short of shameful.
Absolutely. And there are people who support the structure of capitalism and still work to defend these trees. I mean, there's a large swath of people across the political spectrum, I'd say, and some would probably proudly say they're capitalists. But yeah, I mean, this is absolutely an example of that. And it's also why the industry tries to greenwash it. So for instance, they will put something called an FSC stamp. That's the Forest Stewardship Council. They will put that stamp of approval on the wood. Folks might have seen it if you've recently bought wood products from like a Lowe's or a Home Depot or something like that. You'll see it. It's a little stamp. And it means that your wood was harvested sustainably. So hurrah, go build your kids a treehouse. Yet FSC basically means nothing. It is a total greenwashing label. FSC certification has been highlighted by many different journalists in many different countries for stealing indigenous land, for clear cutting old growth forests. Old growth means that it's never been logged before. So you're getting FSC certification from things that were clear cut out of a forest that had never been logged before. Like, this is the greenwashing campaign. And there's also just the visual barrier attempt. You know, if you're driving up the 101 in California, the highway, you won't see these clear cuts because they've got these lines of beautiful trees along the highway. So you get this feeling that you're wandering through a fairy tale. And just on the other side of those trees, it is a deathscape and everything has been clear cut. And so if you look on like Google Earth or something, you'll see it. But who's going to do that? You know, that's not something that people usually think to do. So there's a campaign to try to ensure that people who would argue this point or who would fight don't, because they don't know about it. It is totally greenwashed and propagandized, because you're right. A lot of even capitalists would say that's not okay.
Yeah, it reminds me of all the words that the food industry has come up with to disguise the pesticides, the fungicides, the phony, you know, bad quality ingredients, you know, to hype around. If it isn't organic, well, maybe it's natural or partly natural or sustainably natural. I mean, it's endless BS designed to do exactly in the realm of food what you just showed us there. Okay, and I like it that there are a few capitalists who see that this is a perversion, but it doesn't really address the question, because it is across the board. The beauty of your film is not only the celebration of those trees, but it's a wonderful metaphor for a whole range of areas, which we can deal with separately, but they all come out of that profit-driven system, as if profit maximization trumps everything else. It's extraordinary. All right, I don't want to leave with people being down. What is being done? What are you part of? Because I know you're not alone in this. What can be done? What can you call people who see your film, who hear this interview, watch this interview? What else can be done?
Yeah, so I think, and I get to this in the film, I think one of the primary things that we need to do is shift our relationship with nature. The reason that people even would consider cutting down a redwood for a deck is because we have a totally perverted relationship with nature. And so what we need to do is we need to shift that relationship. And there are different ways of going about that. But I would say part of it is just walking out into a beautiful place, like you mentioned at the beginning of the show, Rick. Walk out into a beautiful place and feel how that feels to exist as part of nature. Because again, the paradigm that we have as ourselves as outside of nature is what's killing us. So we really need to shift that, and then frontline actions and a diversity of tactics, which includes legal fights as well, is really key.
Thank you so much, really, for your work, for your film, for the inspiration. I hope my viewers and listeners understand the importance in the struggle for a better world that we take into account our relationships with nature. It's absolutely crucial. And for those of us that fight the economic fight, just as much. Thank you all. And as always, I look forward to speaking with you again next week.